welcome to the Triangle Radio Reading Service and Sports Illustrated Kids. I am Dick Hayden from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I am filling in for your regular reader, John Ivey. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. We're going to continue with SI Kids for the month of January/February and possibly throw in something from Boys Life to fill out our time as well. Where we left off was with an article titled Centers of Attention, a Guard Game? No Way. College basketball is teeming with centers who are adding a new dimension to the position and leading their teams. Jesse Govan grew up in New York City, birthplace of big-time post players such as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Lamar Odom. Govan, now 6 feet 10 inches tall and a senior center at Georgetown, had his skills tested constantly by competitors, hoping to one-up the top-ranked player in the city. There was always someone trying to go at me, make their name off of me, he says. Govan is fluid around the net and has an expanding perimeter game, a tough combo for opponents. Megan Gustafson grew up in Port Wing, Wisconsin, population 164. Gustafson, now 6'3" senior center at Iowa, had just 11 people in her graduating high school class. Luckily, she says, everyone got along. Her dad was the principal. When she was in the 8th grade, there weren't enough players for a girls' team, so she joined the boys' team. The coach told me one time that I was being too rough on the boys, she says with a laugh. Gustafson is a classic back-to-the-basket player, a bruiser in the post, and a tenacious rebounder. Their backgrounds could not be more different, but they are two of the best centers in the country, part of a large group in both the men's and women's games that is dominating stat sheets and leading teams to prominence. Off-center. Govan has spent the last 2 seasons learning from Patrick Ewing, himself a former Georgetown center and now the school's head coach. Ewing, one of the greatest big men in NBA history, has seen the game evolve since he began his pro career in the mid-1980s. Now they want bigs who can shoot threes and play on the perimeter, Ewing says. Luckily for Ewing, Govan fits that description perfectly, and the coach has encouraged him to use his varied talents to his advantage. I was taught to shoot and dribble and pass, Govan says. I've always been pretty versatile. He's a good shooter, hitting 50% from 3 through 9 games this season. He's also shooting a career-high 58.3% from the field. Despite his height, Govan is comfortable playing on the perimeter, something that he'll have to do in the NBA. There are very few traditional centers in the pros, guys who only play with their backs to the basket and have limited mobility. Kristaps Porzingis of the Knicks, who is 7'3" tall, and is equally adept at shooting threes as he is at boxing out. Philadelphia's Joel Embiid, who grew up playing volleyball, is a 7'0" ballet dancer on the court. Karl Anthony Towns of Minnesota is a terrific three-point shooter, who is also among the league leaders in rebounds. Centers have had to adjust their skill sets. They must be able to step out of the paint. They must also have to be comfortable protecting the rim. While the big man has had to adjust his game, what has not changed is his impact. You're the biggest guy on the court, says Govan. You gotta be dominant. You gotta score, block shots, be a force on offense and defense. Make other teams fear you. Govan is just one of the many big men in the college game right now who are striking fear into opponents. Cameron Kurtwig, a 6'9" sophomore at Loyola Chicago, helped lead the Ramblers to the Final Four last season. Daniel Gafford, a 6'11 sophomore at Arkansas, is averaging 18.5 points and grabbing 8.5 rebounds per game. Ethan Happ, a Wisconsin senior, last season became the first Big Ten player since 1996 to pace his team in points, rebounds, assists, blocks, and steals. Devonte Kaycock, a senior at UNC Wilmington, led the nation in rebounds last year and set the NCAA record for field goal percentage as a sophomore. Central Florida's Taco Fall, the tallest player in the country at 7'6", is particularly adept at disrupting shooters and affecting shots. Moses Brown, a 7'1" freshman at UCLA, scored 19 points and grabbed 17 rebounds in his debut, the first Bruin to do so since Abdul-Jabbar's initial game in 1967. One of the most fearsome centers this season is Bol Bol, B-O-L, B-O-L. He may not be 7'7" like his father, long-time player in the NBA, Manute Bol, but the younger Bol, a 7'2 freshman at Oregon, possesses a unique skill set. Last year, John Calipari, the coach at Kentucky, said that his offensive game was ridiculous. With a 9'7" standing reach, that means he can raise his hands almost to touch the rim. He blocks or impacts nearly every shot taken near him. In a November game against Texas Southern, when he scored 32 points and had 11 rebounds, he hit 4 of his 6 attempts from 3. Danny Manning, the head coach at Wake Forest, told Sports Illustrated that Bol is capable of stepping out on the perimeter and making shots. And his length gives him a chance to do things at the rim that surprise you. He has really soft hands. Govan, who's not quite as agile as Bol, knows that he'll only be successful in college and beyond if he can continue to expand his game past the confines of the paint. During the 2017-18 NBA season, just 6 players averaged 8 or more post-up touches per game. "This suits Jesse's game very well," Ewing says. "He's a very good shooter. And he is one of the best shooting bigs in the game." Posts with the most. The role of the post player in the women's game is evolving as well. But back-to-back basket centers, such as Gustafson, are still in high demand. Gustafson's game is rooted in the post. She led the nation in points per game last season with 25.7. and was one of only 2 NCAA women's basketball players in the last 10 years to average 24 or more points and 12 or more rebounds. "My role is to take my time," she says. "Men can dunk and shoot threes. I see them as being super fast and being able to dribble way more than what I do. I'm more of a traditional post player." Joining Gustafson on the list of the game's elite centers are players such as Kalani Brown, a 6'7" force at Baylor, who set the school's single-season field goal percentage mark as a sophomore, .619, then broke it last spring as a junior. Brianna Turner from Notre Dame was the 2017-18 ACC Defensive Player of the Year. Cal's Christine Angewe entered this season second among active players in career points scored. Then there's Tierra McGowan. The 6'7" Mississippi State senior was the National Defense Player of the Year last season when she grabbed 544 rebounds, second most in NCAA history. Though the Lady Bulldogs fell in the championship game, She set an NCAA tournament record with 109 boards, 18.2 per game, and became the only player in the tournament history to record multiple 20-point and 20-rebound games. That impact will extend to the pros, where post players such as Liz Cambage, a 6'8" center from the Dallas Wings, who led the league in scoring, and Brittany Grenier, a 6'9" center for the Phoenix Mercury, who was sixth in points per game, are dominating. Govan and Gustafson's playing styles are different, but neither one hesitates when asked about the importance of their position, acknowledging that it's the key to a team's success, no matter how flashy a guard is or how high-flying a small forward. A good center can anchor a team and provide stability where it matters most. As Gustafson says, "I see the center as the heart of the team. It's something you can depend on. It's about keeping that steady force." Our next article is titled Breaking Through. In 1947, Jackie Robinson became the first African-American player in Major League Baseball. Many others before and after him shouldered the responsibility of knocking down barriers in their sports. This Black History Month, let's learn about other athletes who came first. Turning first to football, Charles Follis, F-O-L-L-I-S, 1902. The halfback, known as the Black Cyclone, became the first African-American to play pro football when he suited up for the Shelby Athletic Club of Ohio in the early 1900s. Branch Rickey, the general manager who would sign Jackie Robinson to the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947, played with Follis in Ohio and remembered that his teammate endured cruel taunts because of the color of his skin. In boxing, Jack Johnson, 1908. Wow, 110 years ago. Born to parents who had been slaves, Jack Johnson grew up to become the first Black superstar in any sport. After knocking out Canada's Tommy Burns in the 14th round of their bout in Australia, he became the first African-American boxer to claim the world heavyweight title. 2 years later, former heavyweight champ Jim Jeffries came out of retirement to fight Johnson, offering the racist line of reasoning that he was doing it for the sole purpose of winning the title for whites. Jeffries lost 15 rounds, causing violent protests to erupt across the country. Back to football, Woody Strode and Kenny Washington in 1946. Kenny Washington, the first UCLA player to lead the nation in total offense, and Woody Strode were Jackie Robinson's Bruins teammates on the gridiron in the late 1930s. 1 year before Robinson broke MLB's color barrier, Washington and Strode, who had been playing football with the minor league Hollywood Bears, broke the NFL's by signing with the Los Angeles Rams. Washington played 3 years, and Strode played one. When Washington died in 1971, Hall of Famer Bob Waterfield wrote of his former teammate in the L.A. Times, "If he had come into the National Football League directly from UCLA, he would have been, in my opinion, the best the NFL had ever seen." In tennis and golf, we can look to Althea Gibson and 1950. When she stepped onto the court at the U.S. National Championships that year, Gibson became the first African-American player to appear at the event, now called the U.S. Open. And in winning the 1956 French Championships, known today as the French Open, she also became the first to win a Grand Slam. By 1958, she had won four more, along with five doubles titles and a mixed doubles championship. In 1964, she became the first black golfer on the Ladies Professional Golf Association Tour. In basketball, in 1950, Nate Clifton, Chuck Cooper, and Earl Lloyd. In April, the Boston Celtics made Cooper the first African-American player to be drafted into the NBA. Clifton became the first to sign a contract and stick with the team when he agreed to terms with the New York Knicks before the season. And that Halloween, Earl Lloyd, a small forward with the Washington Capitals, was the first black player to enter their game. Clifton and Lloyd, who both ended their NBA careers with the Detroit Pistons, are in the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. And if you get a chance to go to that, it's in Springfield, Massachusetts. Over to baseball, we have Tony Stone, and that's with an I, T-O-N-I, because Tony's a girl. And it was 1953. Says here she grew up playing baseball with the boys, and she played semi-pro and minor league ball with men. Then in 1953, the 32-year-old second baseman, or I should perhaps say second base person, signed with the Indianapolis Clowns of the Negro Leagues, becoming the first woman to play pro ball with men. Stone spent 1 year with the Clowns, getting a hit in an exhibition game against future Hall of Famer Satchel Paige, and won with the Kansas City Monarchs. Over to hockey, we have Willie O'Ree, and the year is 1958. A hockey puck hit O'Ree in the face when he was 19, leaving him blind in his right eye. But that injury did not keep the Canadian from the sport that he loved. When he was 22, he took the ice in two games for the Boston Bruins, becoming the NHL's first black player. The Bruins also called him up from the minors for 43 games during the 1960-61 season. O'Ree played through the 60s and the 70s, mostly in the now-defunct Western Hockey League, and was inducted into the NHL Hall of Fame last year. Our last one is from 1961, and it is in the field of golf. Charlie Sifford. In the spring, the PGA Tour officially granted a player's card to Charlie Sifford, who had already played in the 1959 U.S. Open. And that November, the tour finally did away with its rule stating that membership was for professional golfers of the Caucasian race. Sifford won tournaments in 1967 and 1969, and then won the 1975 Senior PGA Championship. Great congratulations go out to all of those icebreakers. We have an article from Sports Illustrated Kids in the January-February edition, under the heading of Art Connection. And it says, picture perfect. Diagnosed with autism, Devon King, the younger brother of Chargers quarterback Desmond King, is using his passion for sketching to build confidence and communicate with others. And on the page next to it, there's a picture of the two brothers together. It says, brothers and buds, when Desmond moved to L.A. in 2017, Devon decided to attend a nearby college in order to study media arts. If you have watched the Los Angeles Chargers play this season, you've probably noticed Desmond King, the 2017 fifth-round draft pick, who plays the slot cornerback position, is an important part of the defense. He is living out his dream on the field. But there's a person off the field who inspires King, his younger brother, Devon. When Devon was 4, doctors diagnosed him with autism spectrum disorder, which impacted his ability to communicate with other people. But early on, he discovered that he had a talent for art and that he could use that to express himself and build his confidence. So after Desmond was drafted by the Los Angeles Chargers, Devon joined his brother in California, and he enrolled in a nearby college to study media arts. Devon, who turns 20 this year, carries around sketch pads that he fills up with drawings of cartoon characters, musicians, and his favorite athletes, starting, of course, with his brother Desmond. He also drew the design for Desmond's cleats for NFL's My Cause, My Cleats. That's an initiative that allows players to wear custom kicks for one game each season. And what is Devon's dream? It's to work for an animation studio like Pixar. His story and how he has not let anything stop him from doing what he loves. That's what motivates me, says his brother, Desmond, of the Chargers. And on the right-hand side of the page, there's a vertical box, and it's a look at some of Devon's sketchbooks, drawings. It's called Fine Lines, and we can see of these four, the first one is a sketch, very, very accurate-looking sketch of Michael Jordan, formerly of the Bulls, and now owner of the Charlotte Hornets. And then there's the next one is of Black Panther, the movie hero in the action series from Marvel. Of course, he's not going to let you go without seeing his brother. So there's a very fancy drawing here that shows Desmond King in a couple of different poses all at once. It says charges across the bottom. There are two sketches of his head, one with the Chargers emblem across the top. And there's two of him where you can see him full in uniform on the field playing. And the last one that he has for us to look at is a sketch of the Lion King. Very, very realistic. It's quite clear that Devon King is a very capable and talented artist. I'm going to turn now to a couple of items from Boys Life and their January issue. As you know, we have just the Sports Illustrated as a single issue for January and February, and that's not enough material to cover 2 months' worth of weekly programs. So we're supplementing with items from Boys Life that might be of interest to you. We'll be doing the same thing as we move forward into the February programs as well. And hopefully we'll have enough information that we can bring you things that you will find interesting and quite useful. Well, from Boys Life in January, we have an item here. It says, the world's tallest tree. Hyperion, a coast redwood tree in California's Redwood National Park, is known as the tallest tree in the world. How tall? Well, it stands 380 feet ground up to the top. Scientists say that it is 600 years old and contains nearly 20,000 cubic feet of wood. What can we compare that to? Well, how about the Statue of Liberty? It stands 305 feet tall from ground level to the top of the torch. So this tree, 600 years of age, has been growing and growing and growing, and it is 75 feet taller than the Statue of Liberty. And here's something about clouds. We often wonder what's up there, and Some have even asked, well, how much does a cloud weigh? This really is surprising. Under the heading of cloud control, it says that the weight of the average cumulus cloud is 1.1 million pounds. That's the weight of 100 elephants. And I thought these were just little collections of droplets of moisture. But I guess when you get them all together, you end up with 1.1 million pounds on average. No wonder the rain is so hard from time to time when it comes beating down upon our heads. I've got a couple things about heat to go along with this. I may have mentioned this in an earlier program, but it's called Soak Up the Sun. Talk about staying warm this winter. The Parker Solar Probe, NASA's newest spacecraft, is making its long, long journey to the sun. Eventually, it will arrive within 3.85 million miles away from the solar surface, and that will be closer than any other spacecraft in history. I have a hunch if it keeps going on that trajectory, it's also going to run out of space, and there will be a bit of a fizzle as it goes up in smoke. But here's another item about heat. It's called heat wave. This is about the Carolina Reaper pepper. It holds the Guinness World Record for the absolute hottest pepper there is. It scored a 1.6 million SHU on the Scoville scale. That's a measurement of heat in spicy foods. 1.6 million SHU. So how does that compare with other peppers? A bell pepper has zero SHUs. A Poblande, P-O-B-L-A-N-D, pepper has 1,000. Tabasco sauce has 3,750 SHUs. A jalapeno can go from as low as 3,500 to 15,000 SHUs. A chili pepper can go from 30,000 to 50,000 SHU. A cayenne pepper from 30,000 to 50,000 SHU. And the habanero, always thought to be a very, very hot one, it goes from 100,000 to 300,000 SHU. But the Carolina Reaper pepper, 1.6 million SHUs. I guess when you eat that one, you know what they mean when they say, it's going to be a hot time in the old town tonight. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated Kids. We certainly hope that you have enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in every Thursday at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. This program is rebroadcast as noted in the Triangle Radio Reading Service program guide and is readily available as a podcast at our website, www.triangleReadingService.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And if you have any questions or any comments, please call TRRS at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long until next time.